sing with me or repeat after me. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day. We're all gathered here and those far away for the time we share with love and care. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day.
Good morning and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. My name is Tom Phillips, and I'll be your convener for today. Whoever you are and whomever you love, you're welcome here. Unitarian Universalists have no required creed. We believe in the liberal ideal that each person find his or her own path, whether it is working towards inner peace, toward any particular social justice goals, or other religious or spiritual destinations. And so I welcome you to join us today with an open heart and an open mind. Now, announcements are located usually in an insert or somewhere inside the program today. Please note those. And I'll ask only our minister if there's anything to add to those. No? Okay. Great. If you have any questions about those announcements, ask her later. Okay, at this time, I am asking Leah and Nick to help with the chalice lighting.
At this hour, in small towns and big cities, in single rooms and ornate sanctuaries, other Unitarian Universalist congregations are also lighting a flaming chalice. As we light our chalice today, in covenant with all the other UUs, let us remember that we are a part of the great community of faith. Let this dancing flame inspire us to fill our lives with shared ideals of love, justice, and truth.
Thank you, Leah and Nick. All right. Let's see. Okay. Please stand as you're able and join us in singing hymn number 349 in the large green hymnal, We Gather Together. Large gray, but it's not teal. Yeah, okay. Gray?
It is gray.
Now is the time in our service when we share those special joys and sorrows that we carry in our hearts and minds. Please raise your hand and then wait for the microphone to come to you so that you can be heard by all.
I'm Roger Johnson. Opie, won't mind if I share this joy. 52 years ago today, 52 years, I was in a dining room in one of the nicer hotels in Cedar Rapids. And yes, such places exist. And I was getting ready. We were having the pre-wedding dinner that my future mother and father-in-law threw for this pretty young woman and me. We were to get married the following day. And at that dinner that evening, Linda's father was the first to give a toast. And his words were brief, but they were very telling. What he said was, 23 years ago, we brought Linda home from the hospital, and we knew that at some point she would get married and bring a man to the family. But for the last 23 years, I've been living with these two women, my wife and my daughter. And now that she is bringing a man into the family, I can only say that I am absolutely thrilled that she is marrying somebody who can out-talk them both.
Good morning, Christopher Renner. I coordinate an Italian club here in town, and as you know, in August there was a devastating earthquake in Italy that leveled part of Umbria and the Marche regions in Italy. We're going to be doing a fundraiser. I'm cooking all day Wednesday and Thursday for this. So on Friday evening at St. Thomas More, it's pasta alla amatriciana, which is a sauce from one of these villages that was devastated, salad and dessert, and a suggested donation of $12. If you want a ticket, see me afterwards.
Susan Adamchak, I just wanted to let you know that Barbara had a little bit of a relapse this past week and has gone back to Bramlage House for some rest and recuperation, but she's in good spirits and sends thank yous to everyone who helped out in the last couple of weeks.
Well, look, I'm going to just double up. I shouldn't say so much in a service, but I love to see our fellowship, UUFM, mentioned in the local newspaper, the Mercury. And, you know, I'm always pretty definite that I'll see it on Fridays, you know, and I always turn to that section and look and see what's going on. But there's a front page story today that mentions UUFM and John Lou Johnstone, so I recommend that you check that out. And now I want to invite the children to come forward and all the older folks to listen carefully to the story for all ages. Anybody ever read this book? What's the name of it? Okay, Love You Forever. All right, yeah. I remember I read this to my kids. And a Google search on the topic just got me there right away. Okay, Love You Forever. Okay. A mother held her new baby, all right, and very slowly rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she held him, she sang, "I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." Aha. Uh-huh. Then the baby grew. He grew and he grew and he grew. What room of the house is he in? The bathroom. Is he being a good baby boy? Yeah. He's just pulling toilet paper, and he's got somebody's watch very close to the toilet bowl. Anyway... He grew until he was 2 years old, and he ran all around the house. He pulled all the books off the shelves, he pulled all the food out of the refrigerator, and he took his mother's watch, and flushed it down the toilet. Sometimes his mother would say, "This kid is driving me crazy." But at nighttime, when that two-year-old was quiet, she opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, looked up and over the side of his bed. See, she's on her knees looking at this sleeping two-year-old. And if he was really asleep, she picked him up and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. While she rocked him, she sang, "I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." All right, so the little boy grew. He grew and he grew and he grew. He grew until he was 9 years old. There's a 9-year-old boy. What's he into? Can you tell us what he likes? Baseball. What's he got in his mouth? Gum, not just any gum, bubble gum, yeah. And there's a lot of mud coming in the kitchen with him. But anyway, and he never wanted to come in for dinner. He never wanted to take a bath. And when Grandma visited, he always said bad words. Sometimes his mother wanted to sell him to the zoo. But at nighttime, when he was asleep, the mother quietly opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, and looked up over the side of the bed. If he was really asleep, she picked him up, that 9-year-old boy, and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." See? Rocking a 9-year-old kid, that's kind of heavy at that point. But just wait. All right. The boy grew. He grew and he grew and he grew until he was a teenager. He had strange friends, and he wore strange clothes, and he listened to strange music. Aren't these timeless statements? Yeah. I don't know what the copyright is, but it never changed. Sometimes the mother felt like she was in a zoo. Okay, what's he doing there? Is he imitating some sort of singer? Who do you think? Elvis. Who knows who Elvis is? Okay, we got a demographic thing going on here. Okay. Anyway, let's see. Listen to strange music. Oh, she wanted to take him to the zoo. But at nighttime, when the teenager was asleep, the mother opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, and looked up over the side of the bed. If he was really asleep, she picked up that great big boy and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. While she rocked him, she sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." So here she is, peeking in through the door, on her knees, thinking about it. But, you know, I guess she's going to rock him. So, wow. That teenager grew. He grew and he grew and he grew. He grew until he was a grown-up man. He left home, and he got a house across town. So this is movers moving in this young man's furniture into the new house. But sometimes, just guess what, on dark nights, the mother got into her car and drove across town. Crazy, right? What's on top of the car, you guys? A ladder. A ladder on top of the car. She did put a safety flag on there, which is good. If all the lights in her son's house were out, she opened his bedroom window, crawled across the floor, looked up over the side of his bed. If that great big man was really asleep, she picked him up and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. There's maybe a little, you know, literary license here. And while she rocked him, she sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby, you'll be." All right. Okay, well, that mother, she got older. She got older and older and older. One day she called up her son and said, "You'd better come see me because I'm very old and sick." So her son came to see her. Okay, so here's the son. He's an older guy, right? What's he doing? Cooking, right? What's he cooking anyway? He's actually cooking mushrooms, which I thought was pretty cool. And he's going to make a salad or something. But anyway, so her son came to see her. And when he came to the door, she tried to sing the song. She sang, "I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always." But she couldn't finish because she was too old and sick. The son went to his mother. He picked her up and rocked her back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And he sang the song, "I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my mommy you'll be," right? So he's got her in the rocking chair. So when the son came home that night, he stood for a long time at the top of the stairs. What else is at the top of the stairs? The cat. They're always there waiting for you, right? Usually they're hiding. But Then he went into the room where his very new baby daughter was sleeping. He picked her up in his arms and very slowly rocked her back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while he rocked her, he sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." How many have read this story before? What is it about? I guess it's kind of obvious. This kind of goes with the theme that we're going to talk about in service today, which is covenant, which is, you know, it's a promise, but they didn't sign a contract here. It's all part of the deal. So I love my kids. Pretty sure they love me. And I love my mom, too. Okay. So time for RE.
Covenant. Covenant is the basis of families. Covenant is the basis of our congregation. And we have a little exercise for you here. That there's a card inside your order of service, and this is actually connecting with something that's going to happen in a couple of months when Dori Davenport, our regional person, is coming. She wanted us to have your opinions, your thoughts about this question. This is the congregation of. Now, the trick here is no more than six words. No more than six words. This is the congregation of. Complete it. No more than six words. And what we're going to do is right now... The baskets are coming around with pencils and pens if you need a writing device to use. Or you can just use your own writing device if you happen to have one. It's not a required thing, but we would love to have you put these in the offering plate or the offering basket when it comes along with your offering gifts. But we'll take just a moment to write, and then Tom will have something to say before we start the offering. Was it six words or no more? Okay, we'll finish up. When we pass the basket for the offering, you can throw the paper in there. All right? Okay, so the offering is a sign of a symbol of our covenant together. We are able to do more together than we can do separately because we offer UUFM our time, our talents, and our treasure.
Now for the gifts that we have received and the gifts that we ourselves are, may we truly be grateful. And again?
Put not only your treasure, but your six words in here.
Thank you, Renee. Well, the hymn prior to the reflections is number 1023 in the teal hymnal, the paperback, titled Building Bridges. Now, a few instructions here. It's actually sung as a round, okay, a cappella. It's a four-part round, divided the sanctuary into four parts. So on this side, there's a, and the order will be, yeah, Chris is going to lead that side, maybe. No, Chris is going to, well, yeah, we'll get the two Chrises. There you go. We're comparing notes here. That's all right, Michael. Yeah, that's good. That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, amazing, great minds. Okay, so there's four sections, and we're going to actually hear the tune all the way through from Renee, and then we'll follow, each group will sing twice. Four singings. Okay, it's going to be an awesome round, okay? But you come in after the first one. So the first group will start here with line one, and then when they start line two, you'll sing line one, and then you'll sing line one, and then you'll sing line one. You remember what rounds are, right? Yeah, you're last. I'm going to lead you guys. Two, three, four. Yeah, I'm going counterclockwise, right? Yeah. She's gonna play the tune, just so we know it.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right, a few words before we hear from John Alou. Okay. As I mentioned, the worship theme for this month and the topic of John Alou's reflection today is covenant. But where do you start? Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines covenant as a usually formal, solemn, and binding agreement. Some will think, as a verb, and this is grammar, so I have no idea, but anyway, to promise by a covenant, or another type of verb is to enter into a covenant. I'm looking at the writers back there. Anyway, some will think of the reference from the Jewish and Christian theology that some of us grew up with, that a covenant is an agreement between God and God's people. There are, of course, more legal definitions of covenant as well. The New York Times columnist David Brooks put it this way: when we go out and do a deal, we make a contract. When we are situated within something, it is because we have made a covenant. A contract protects interests, but a covenant protects relationships. A covenant exists because people who understand they are part of one. It involves a vow to serve the relationship that is sealed by love. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people shall be my people. People in a contract provide one another services, but people in a covenant delight in offering gifts. Out of love of country, soldiers offer the gift of their service. Out of love of their craft, teachers offer students the gift of their attention. So these words of Brooks point out a little background, and it allows us to appreciate that for Unitarian Universalists, our covenant is an agreement about how we will strive to be in relationship with one another and with the world around us. And with that, John Alou.
Thanks, Tom. Explaining Unitarian Universalism can be a challenge. Has anyone ever done this? Have you tried to explain it to someone? So you might have had a friend or family member say, so what is this UU fellowship all about? And one of the first things that we usually say is that it's non-creedal. That is, that there's no particular set of beliefs. And that's hard for people to understand, because the definition of religion from a Christian perspective is the beliefs, the creeds. Christianity has tended over time, less among some of the Eastern Orthodox and maybe some others, but primarily it has defined itself according to belief. The UU minister Tom Belote, who used to be minister at the Shawnee Mission UU congregation over in Lenexa, tells about being at a protest of abstinence-only sex education. And a couple of reporters from a religious magazine interviewed him, and this is how he describes the conversation. I introduced myself as a Unitarian Universalist minister. They asked me how to spell that. And then they asked me to explain what UUs believe. I explained that we're a covenantal faith, not a creedal faith. We share a covenant of how we try to be together, not a creed of what we all must believe together. And then the questions really began. Well, what does your church believe about? Does your church believe in the Bible? They asked. Tom's response, that is a creedal question. We are a covenantal congregation. We share a covenant of how we try to be together, not what we are expected to believe together. Well, does your church believe in God? They asked. That is a creedal question. We're a covenantal faith. We share a covenant of how we try to be together, not what we are expected to believe together. This went on for a while. It took them a while to get what he's saying. Then Tom writes, I think that sometimes we stress the fact that we are not a creedal faith a lot more than we stress that we are a covenantal faith. We emphasize the creeds we are not asked to recite more than the covenants we are asked to share. We overemphasize the fact that we are not necessarily required to believe in God or believe a certain doctrine about the Bible or the afterlife, and we underemphasize the covenantal dimensions of our shared faith, preferring not to articulate those covenants of behavior that we do share. So, Non-creedal, yes. As my colleague Mark Christian often says, churches don't believe anything. People do. And without a set of beliefs we subscribe to, it is our covenant that bonds us together. Now, we UUs did not invent the idea of covenant, even though it seems made for us. We are covenantal, but so are many other faiths, particularly those that descend from Abraham, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. Even Baha'i, Zoroastrianism, too, have covenantal aspects. The earliest covenants identified, though, are actually before any of those religions. They're Near Eastern treaties between suzerains, or powerful kings, and their vassals, less powerful leaders, who agreed to the treaties not only on their own behalf, but on the behalf of their people. The Hebrews used similar patterns of preambles and commitments, blessings and curses, in their covenant or agreement with God as suzerain. Now, I could go into the whole covenant legacy with Noah and Abraham and Moses, but you've heard that before, probably. Instead, I'm going to mention a different biblical covenant, and Tom quoted it. It's one you might not think of, the covenant between Ruth and Naomi. Ruth was Naomi's daughter-in-law. She was a Moabite, married to a Hebrew, Naomi's son, and they lived in Moab. But times got hard, and there was a famine, and Ruth's husband, Naomi's son, died. Naomi told Ruth and her other widowed daughter-in-law, Orpah, to return to their birth families, and she set out to go back to Israel. And Orpah did as Naomi said and went back to her parents. But Ruth refused, saying these words, "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will be buried. And where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me and more as well, if even death parts me from you." So you've probably heard those words before, even before Tom read them. You've probably heard them at weddings, often read at marriage ceremonies, even heterosexual marriage ceremonies. Because nowhere else in the Bible, certainly not in the context of marriage, are there such beautiful and profound words of commitment. I will stay with you. I will go with you. I will be with you. That is what covenant means. And I like this one because it's a covenant between two people. And similarly, of the covenant between David and Saul's son Jonathan, a relationship that some queer theologians have construed as gay, 1 Samuel tells us that Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, for he loved him as he loved his own life. His promise was a radical commitment informed by deep love. One of my favorite poems by the Sufi poet Rumi makes a similar connection. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. The field is beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing because in this frame of mind, connection matters more than blame or fault. It's like the story Tom read this morning. I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. And you likely have one or more relationships in your life where you have no doubt that connection matters most. Your spouse or partner, your children, your parents. If the question is, do I forgive? Then the answer is, of course. It's complicated, though. There are some actions that are not forgivable, or at least may take decades of therapy before we can forgive. Multilingual, multicultural studies professor Marcia Pally speaks and writes about two concepts I find helpful. And it's referred to in the David Brooks piece, separability and situatedness. Separability, the ability to think separately from others, to live differently from people around us. That was fundamental to the development of Western culture. It freed us to move away from our families of origin, to set aside traditional ideas that limited us, to innovate and create philosophically, scientifically, and technologically. It also persuaded us that we can be individuals unmoored from a cultural context, unreliant on others for our origins or our development, that we did not need one another, and that exploitation of others, especially others unlike us, was justifiable. So the counter to separability is situatedness, the sense that our individuality comes out of a complex web of relationships, community, culture, family, perhaps even God or the universe. So separability and situatedness fit together and require striving for balance, like yin and yang. While being overly situated may lead to a kind of groupthink where we are unable to develop our own ideas, in contrast, being overly separable can lead to self-centeredness, disengagement from others and from the common good, and to the delusion of self-sufficiency. Pali proposes a relational theology where we are separable amid situatedness. In other words, we acknowledge and appreciate our relationality, where we came from, who we depend on, who depends on us. Yet we maintain our individuality within that situatedness. So an intentional practice of covenant reminds us where and how we are situated. We recognize how we are a part of one another. Pali talks about a process of reciprocal consideration and worthiness as an ethics guide in this sort of relationality. And what that means is that we consider not a list of rules, but we look at our own point of view in a particular situation, but also we look at the point of view of others, even if they disagree or have hurt us. So the concerns of others become as worthy as our own concerns. And this is hard stuff, because in most situations, I can see my own point of view far more clearly than anyone else's. My healthy ego does not like being squashed by your disagreement. But if we are in covenant, I know that my fortune is intimately tied up with yours. So I have to let go of my concerns at least long enough to listen to yours. I have to be aware that I could be wrong. In short, I have to be humble. A covenant grounds and guides us. It helps us know what to expect of one another and of ourselves. But it doesn't give us a set of rules or laws. Instead, we look at how our behavior affects others with whom we are situated. Now, in this sense, I've seen covenant contrasted in a classroom setting with a list of rules. So if there's a rule against hitting, then a child who hits another is reminded it's against the rule and punished by the adult in charge for an infraction of the rules. But if there's a covenant in contrast, then the goal is to get back into right relationship, to explore what happened between these two children, how they want to be together again, and what it will take for them to work together again instead of against one another. So there's not a specific formula. Whatever our age or stage, there are no covenant police to toss you in jail for your failures. The Methodist Church consultant Gil Rendell calls it the domain of obedience to the unenforceable. The thing is, its unenforceability doesn't matter because it is each person's commitment to the covenant that matters. You've bought into it. You accept it. You enforce it on yourself. Now, that doesn't mean that someone might not bring a lapse to your attention. But if handled in the spirit of covenant, the process will strive to be gentle because we hold one another in love. Recently, a colleague of mine told me that in her congregation, sometimes covenant gets used as an accusation. You're out of covenant. Now, that's not how it works. 20th century UU theologian James Luther Adams said that covenant includes a rule of law but is not a legal framework. It depends on faithfulness, loyalty, and indeed love. Violation of the covenant is a violation of trust. What holds the world together, according to this dual covenant, then, is trustworthiness. Eros. Love. How does it work then? I think it begins not with you're out of covenant, but with I sense that we are out of covenant. That means my first step is to look at how I have fallen short rather than to look at what someone else has done to me. And again, to do this requires humility. It's about individual behavior, yes, but it's about our behavior not only in but as community. If we commit to living out our values only with certain people but not with others, we're not being loyal to our values. Nor can we mete out love as an abstract quality or to an abstract entity without striving to make it come alive with real living human beings who are imperfect. Because we all are. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker spoke about it in relation to the entire country. He said, love of country necessitates love of each other. That we have to be a nation that aspires for love, which recognizes that you have worth and dignity and I need you. You are part of my whole, part of the promise of this country. And what you could do, you could substitute any covenantal group for country, this fellowship, a town, being part of one another is what covenant is all about. And if we're to be part of one another, that means we are committed. We promise one another something. The Jewish theologian Martin Buber called human beings the promise-making, promise-keeping, promise-breaking, promise-renewing creature. Which brings us to one of those difficult questions. Is a covenant eternal and unbreakable? The Hebrew Bible actually paints two kinds of covenants, one eternal and the other conditional. Of course, that's because different people wrote different parts of the scriptures, and like all people throughout time, they struggled and disagreed around such challenging ideas. At least one author asserts that if people quit obeying, Jehovah just doesn't do so hot with keeping up his end of the deal, causing the Israelites all kinds of suffering. And others have a different focus over and over spelling out how God keeps promises always. So what's clear from the perspective of a covenant among people is that there will be breaks. I will disappoint you, and you will disappoint me. That's inevitable. That's what Buber meant when he said that we are a promise-breaking creature. We can never live up to our highest expectations of ourselves. And we've also established that covenant is unenforceable, or at best, its enforcement depends on each of us examining our own behavior to move forward. Now, that's why the first step in the conflict resolution process that's outlined in our congregational covenant is self-reflection. And we have a set of questions that can be considered in that process. So then we recommend direct engagement with whomever the conflict is with. And this is in contrast to speaking with a bunch of other people and making the conflict bigger than it has to be. Again, humility, a recognition I could be wrong, and that the relationship is more important than it is for me to be right. Covenant becomes a framework for our relations, even a spiritual practice. Back in 1630, John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts, knew this when he addressed a group of Puritan immigrants sailing to New England aboard the ship, the Arabella. He said, "We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities. Yeah, that's a word we say every day. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other. We must delight in each other. Make others' conditions our own. Rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission and community in the work as members of the same body. So shall we keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." Or as contemporary UU minister Victoria Safford has said, "The whole idea of governing this way is that we stand up, show up for each other, to hear each other's questions and opinions, and maybe be made wiser, maybe deepen, maybe grow, maybe even change our minds. The whole idea of covenant is that we walk together, open-minded, open-hearted. It is old-fashioned, centuries old, and it is radically new." So we'll sum up with a video. So a lot of questions. They ended that with a lot of questions, questions to ask ourselves, deep personal questions, as well as questions about our involvement in the community, in the world. And you've heard about our new focus on themes. This is covenant that we're starting with. And another aspect of that focus is going to be chalice circles, which is a way of engaging more deeply with our questions. This is kind of a unique approach to questions. A lot of small group materials include discussion questions, and in the traditional model, questions serve as tools to keep the discussion focused and structured, but we're going to use questions differently. They're tools for individual exploration, and instead of asking our groups to go through questions one by one and discuss them, we invite group members to read through all the questions ahead of time and find one or two questions that hook them, that speak to them in some dramatic way, and then we invite group members to live with that question or walk with that question. And so group members come to a meeting not with an answer to each of the questions on the list, but with a story about how they've interacted and engaged with the questions. And we want to demonstrate that to you a little bit this morning. So I'm going to invite the facilitators who are present, and I think it may just be Susan and Jane, and I'll sit down with you, to show what kind of what this will look like in a chalice circle. So we've got, we'll just need three chairs.
Susan and Jane and I have had these questions with us and been able to look through them and think about them a little bit. So I'd ask you to, as you talk about it, to just read the question and then talk about your experience with it.
I sat in the middle thinking if I were on the end, I would have to go first. Darn. There are 12 questions on covenant in the packet on covenant. And I chose this one because it was an incident that happened in my life, and it caused me to reflect on this question. And so the question I chose was, covenant rightly calls us to work on repairing relationships and sticking in there even when it is hard. This is something that happened during the month of September. A number of women go to McDonald's for coffee on Mondays and Thursdays. All women are invited. And one Thursday, or Monday, I don't know what it was, not long ago, we were meeting there, and one of the women came in, and I immediately interacted with her by telling a joke, an offhanded joke. She burst into tears. I was floored, just floored. And all these questions, what do I do now? How do I repair this? How can I bring us back into relationship? I was tempted to get up and leave because I was so uncomfortable. I was crying by this time. She was weeping. And I thought, I can't stand this discomfort. I'm just going to walk out of here. But then I knew that if I walked out of there, how in the world would I ever walk back in at the next coffee time? What sort of a, I don't know, who would I be at the next coffee time in relation to this group and especially in relation to this woman? So in spite of my discomfort, I thought the best thing to do is to stay. And I stayed, and we got past it. The conversation went on to something else. And then it was time for us to leave. And I made it a point to go to her and give her a big hug before we left. And then she said, it could have been I who said that would have been nice since I offended her. She said, I'm going to call you tomorrow and we'll get together and talk about this. And she did, and we did. And she told me what was really on her mind. And she thanked me for giving her a reason to break down and cry because she really, really needed to. So I felt that our commitment to the whole group had been reestablished and our covenant continued.
I've reflected on two of the questions on the list during the past couple of weeks. They're somewhat connected in the way that I've been thinking about them. The first is, what promises have you made to those who have gone before? Well, many of you know that my first husband passed away 16 years ago now. And I made a promise to him that I would never buy a convertible sports car. Adam had brain cancer, and we were very lucky in that after his initial surgery and radiation therapy, he actually had a very, very wonderful quality of life for the remaining months that he had. And we didn't hide what he was going through. We knew he had a terminal illness. We didn't know how long that would last. And it forced us to be really, really honest with each other. And we had a lot of conversations about what was going to happen next. It was really difficult. It was really, really hard knowing that I would be surviving to have him still be trying to take care of me. I can tell you very explicitly, we were in our pickup truck driving to Wamego to have breakfast at that little cafe on Main Street. And he insisted that we talk about which car I would keep of our several vehicles, where I would live, which friends I would rely on. And, you know, it was just a wonderful gift that he was able to keep giving me, as difficult as it was to receive that gift. The second question that I was reflecting on is, what is the most life-giving promise you've made? The gift that Adam gave me in being able to confront his death has helped me help other people deal with what they've gone through. One of my very close friends, my locker mate from high school, she died 10 years ago of breast cancer. During the last month of her life when she was in the hospital, there was a group of seven of us who were extremely close. The six survivors all made pilgrimages to Susan's bedside and brought different things. Nancy, who is righteous and angry all the time about everything, argued with the nurses about the type of care that Susan was getting. Kate, who is herself a nurse, persuaded the staff to let her take Susan outside in a wheelchair where she was able to feel the sunshine on her face. When I was with her, I spelled her husband for a few hours and we had some time together. And I was able to sit and hold her hand and ask her if she feared dying. And at that point, she could barely talk. There were a few words. But she had the most beautiful, expressive blue eyes. And she looked at me and she nodded. And I was able to talk with her and to share some of what I had gone through with Adam, to assure her that her children would be taken care of, that her husband loved her very much, and that her friends were with her, and we all cared for her. And in that way, that experience that I had, I was able to bring and share that covenant with another person who was so close to me in my heart. I don't know if this is giving you the impression that our chalice circles are going to be,
You're fine.
I'll talk about the question that resonated with me, which is, have you made a covenant with the holy? What promises have you made to life itself, to God, to your inner voice? Because that's something that I have continually reflected on through my life, particularly with my choice of career as ministry, because I very much see my decision to go into ministry as a covenant with the holy, a commitment to help people with that, to help people better understand the holy and how we live in it together and how we move through life with a sense of the sacred. And there have been times that my theology has evolved a lot during the time that I've been a UU minister. And I've gotten more theistic. There have been times that I said, is this really what I'm supposed to be here with, like, all these humanists and what? How, you know? But I've continually sort of gotten that reassurance of, yes, this is what you are supposed to be doing. I've gotten just as if it were a clear message. You know, even an affirmation of where I was. I was 13 years at in Oklahoma City at First Church there, and I feel like through most of that time I was reaffirmed, this is where you're supposed to be. And a couple of years ago, when I asked the question again, I got the sense that, maybe not. You know? And I feel like my path here to this congregation and to Manhattan is part of keeping my promises to the sacred, to the holy, and living into that promise. So we have a few minutes to say if we have any questions or thoughts to one another or with one another here.
One of the things in our chalice circles is that I made that little bulletin board out there, and the words that are on the side of the bulletin board are all words that I took out of the packet for new participants. And they're all very positive words, like covenant and relationship and things of that sort. The only negative word or set of words that I included was no fixing. Because this experience differs from other group experience in that we all listen to one another and we all take a turn and nobody jumps in and says, oh, but you could have. And did you ever consider, or whatever? Nothing of that sort. And I was visiting with someone prior to our meeting this morning, and she said, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that. That sounds like it's just so heady, you know, or so intellectual, discussing covenant. And it's not that at all. It's not an intellectual discussion at all. It's an experiential thing. It's living into covenant.
I think that the stories that both of you all told are so deep and touching, and I think engaging with those things of our life that are deep and touching is what ultimately deepens our connections among ourselves and deepens our connections with whatever it is, you know, with the sacred, with life, with spirituality, whatever. Thoughts?
I think what's drawing me to this idea of the circles is having an opportunity to just be a little bit more self-reflective and a little bit more intentional in the way that I go about my daily life. Certainly, you know, I've thought of other things with being a relatively new member of this congregation. What are my personal ideas of covenant? Now that I'm meeting a new circle of friends and companions, what are the covenants that I bear with them? And I think that, you know, it's just kind of carving out a few minutes a day or during the week or the month to be more appreciative of what's going on in my life and in the lives of my companions. So.
I think that's a nice place to end it. Thank you.
Please stand as you're able and join us in hymn 129 in the hardbound book. And it's our thematic hymn for the month, 129, Let Love Continue Long.
From Duke T. Gray, the blessing of truth be upon us, the power of love direct us and sustain us, And may the peace of this community preserve our going out and our coming in from this time forth until we meet again.